So Brooks Richards, reel 7.
The Algiers resistance group, as I was saying, something of the order of 200 strong, largely refugee and largely Jewish, and potentially also a number of young men who were in the Chantier de Jeunesse camps outside Algiers and in Oran, whose chief, a Colonel Van Heck of Belgian origin, had been in touch with Murphy. But the situation had been much complicated by the arrival of Darlan in Algiers prior to the landing, in circumstances which still occupy researchers as a matter of importance. Verrier will be dealing with this in his book. But then the further complication of Giraud being brought out from France, very much against his will, on a British submarine, the Jewel. He really wanted to stay in France and to persuade the Americans to land a force there. But this, of course, they were quite unwilling and unable to do. And the result of this, as I say, there was the Americans were in touch with a range of people from the number two in the Vichy regime, the person of Darlan, with a lot of people who had been in North Africa in one capacity or another, and who were at least strongly against the Vichy regime, though some of them worked for it. People like the chief of police, Ashiari, or the chief of the counter-espionage branch of the Algiers police, Ashiari. And the key people whom it was desired to arm was this small Algiers group. And we were sent, first of all, to this Cherchel rendezvous point. And Brian Clark gives the date of the operations the night of the 4th, 5th. And then his report quite correctly recounts we were switched to a rendezvous point east of Algiers, as no one had shown up at this Cherchel point. Well, in fact, it's now quite clear that the little resistance group in Algiers said they couldn't possibly collect the stuff from Cherchel, it must be brought nearer, and had given an alternative point near Cape Matifou, east of Algiers, where they had a sympathizer who had a large estate, a place called Ain Taya. And we went to this second rendezvous. My own recollection, in fact, is that we had been two nights to the Cherchel beach. And I think that in the account of Brian Clark, 4th, 5th, in fact, that masks the fact that we had been on two different nights already there. We went on to the second revised pinpoint that had been given us by radio, and no one came to that either. So we decided we couldn't hang about. It was really very awkward. This 400-ton ship had got to be taken offshore before dawn each day, but she was in a position where she was very easily spottable by any aircraft flying up and down. And the nearer we got to the date of the actual main landing operation, the more certain that there would be a good deal of overflight, and that we would be given away and no doubt destroyed. So we decided we'd have to go back to Algiers with our mission unfulfilled. And the result of this was quite important in that very few weapons were available for the little Algiers group when they seized communication points on the night of the 7th, 8th. Well, Minna had no sooner got back to Gibraltar than we were ordered to keep the cargo on board, turn round and join the Allied convoys for the landing. And we fell in with the convoys and headed eastwards, and being somewhat delayed on the way by the fact that the one ship in the Allied convoy heading for Algiers, I think in the Allied convoys totally, that got torpedoed was a collier in, and we were in the vicinity at the time when this occurred, so we had to pick up survivors and try and resuscitate them. And we spent a good deal of what I think must have been the day of the 8th of, or possibly the 9th of November, doing this duty. Almost everybody we picked up, in fact, was beyond resuscitation, except for one old fellow who was from the engine room of this sunken ship. And just when we were about to abandon our search, which we carried out throughout the daylight hours, he was spotted, having got two hatch cover boards across each other and got himself draped over the centre of this. And though men much younger than him had been, much younger than he had been drowned, he'd survived in this way. We got him back on board, and next morning after a night's sleep, by breakfast he was in fine form and eating a good breakfast as we came into Algiers. Well, there I met up with the rest of small SOE mission. I don't recall, it's quite possible that we chipped them in the Minna, though I'm not absolutely sure of that. But there was a Colonel Anstruther in charge. There was a man called Hamish Torrance, a major of the HLI, as his number two, who'd been in Norway with Colin Gubbins, had escaped through Sweden or Finland, and who was subsequently to serve in Greece, the SOE. There was a signals officer whose name escapes me. And there was myself as a sort of paranaval chap. And we berthed, first of all, in Algiers Harbour, which had just been opened, because at the actual landing, the attempt to break the boom with two British destroyers, the Brooke and the Malcolm, had failed, and they'd been very badly mauled by French naval gunfire. So that it wasn't till the evening of the 9th that Algiers Harbour was open. I think we probably got in very early after the harbour was opened, but comparatively soon thereafter we were ordered out and to Cape Matifou, east of Algiers, where a camp was being set up for these people who'd helped us get ashore, the little resistance group, all of whom found themselves in imminent danger of arrest from Vichy authorities, who were still in full control as a result of the decision by General Mark Clark and Bob Murphy to deal with Darlan, who had been arrested by one of them, Bernard Pouvillier, and who subsequently got free, continued his negotiations with the Americans, and we decided that the only thing to do with these young Gaullists, because that's what they were, was to put them in British uniform and put them under British command, and we set up camp to do this at Ain Taya on this estate east of Algiers. And I came ashore from Minna after we'd landed our cargo, and from then onwards, my involvement in the treason campaign was very largely a shore one, because only a few days later, Anstruther told us that we were going to make our way as fast as we could east to Tunisia, where there was a race on for Bizerta and Tunis itself, where no one was quite sure how far the Germans got in landing. And the British First Army had not landed at Bougie or Philippeville, which had been considered at the time, but rejected, mainly because there wasn't aircraft cover or naval cover, really, to look after the convoys going that far east. So, First Army's first troops, which were in practice numbers 1 and 6 Commando, which had been prominently involved in the landing in Algiers itself, well, on beaches to the west of Algiers, and it played a very important part in that landing, were being moved as fast as possible eastwards, and we caught up with them at either Bougie or Philippeville, I'm not absolutely sure, but we drove up in requisition cars, and our journey was complicated with the fact that I drove in the middle of the night after we'd been 17 or 18 hours continuously on the road. I drove into a tree through falling asleep, and my colonel, Anstruther, sitting beside me, was concussed. He didn't make an awful lot of sense in the ensuing days, but poor fellow. At any rate, we got up, we went through Constantine, first of all, and we spent a night at Constantine, which was, of course, inland, and there, rather amusingly, we had a party come to volunteer to join us, who were the Communist Rail Women's Union group from Constantine. And next morning they got higher instructions from a higher level. They'd been told, no, they weren't on our side yet, so they marched out again. And we continued eastwards. We went to Guelma, where we requisitioned a house or two, and left behind somebody who found a very good training establishment up in the mountains at a place called La Mahuna. Right, I went on further eastwards and got to the Tunisian frontier before the first British troops crossing into Tunisia, certainly on the coast. The first British troops on the coast were the two commanders who were coming up, and Randolph Churchill had been, as a captain, sent on ahead by Colonel Glendinning, who commanded the two commandos, to requisition accommodation for number one and number six commando in Tabarka, which is a little port just over the Tunisian border. And when I arrived there, there was no sign of him. I discovered he'd been there. And I was naturally rather intrigued as to where he'd gone. Well, they said he'd been seen disappearing off to the east on the pillion of a motor bicycle driven by a man whom the Americans seemed to know about called Durand. Well, I thought, how remarkable. Obviously, this like father, like son, he'd decided to go off, investigate behind enemy lines, if any, and got on with my own business. The immediate situation that I was confronted with was that I had an introduction to the French Contrôleur Civil, because Tunisia, as a protectorate, like Morocco, had parallel Arab and French administrations. And a place the size of this little port would have the Contrôleur Civil, who was the equivalent of a sous-préfet in France, and alongside him an Arab official who was the Qaid. And my immediate job was, using what help I could get from Monsieur Kilikini, the Contrôleur Civil, to land a couple of agents up in Bizerta with the object of getting some means of reporting the arrival of the Germans up there as and when it occurred. So a couple of agents had been found. They were a young Frenchman called Enes and a black French NCO, probably a Senegalese, I should think, called Daporto. And the Navy had turned up with some landing craft, and I went to see Captain N.V. Dickinson, who was in charge, and number one and number six commando were arriving, and Will Glendinning running round asking where on earth Randolph Churchill got to, and was told, well, he disappeared off to the east. So Glendinning decided, difficult as the situation was, he'd better report the Prime Minister's son had disappeared towards the enemy's lines. So he sent a telegram saying that Captain Churchill had volunteered for a dangerous mission and they'd be out of contact for some time. Amazingly, this was after Randolph had got into some trouble through as British spokesman over the Tobruk blockade. I think he'd been sacked for having made rash predictions about what was going to happen in the Eighth Army campaign. But nothing daunted, he joined number one, number six commando and come in this way and had got ahead of them and disappeared. But Glendinning concealed the fact that he hadn't authorised Randolph to go off on this jaunt. Anyway, my immediate problem was solved by the offer of a couple of naval landing craft to take us up to Bizerta. So we set off, And I can't pinpoint the date of this at the minute without further research, but we got all the way up to Bizerta, and it would have been a blind beach landing, no reception party. The Porto had a radio set, and Ines was supposed to be in charge. But when we got there, it was blowing too stiffly onshore for it to be possible for us to take the landing craft in. Landing craft was, interestingly enough, commanded, I think, that night. And certainly, I had a lot of subsequent help from him by somebody who's a neighbour of mine today, Vice Admiral Sir Gerard Mansfield, Jed to his friends, who was then a naval sub-lieutenant. Anyway, we decided we couldn't put this landing craft onto the beach without endangering her, so we turned round and made our way back along the coast. But we hadn't got anywhere near as far as Tabarka when dawn began to break, and we decided it would be extremely hazardous to be seen in daylight that far east, so we decided to go in the lee of a headland called Cap Serra, which got a lighthouse on it and a naval semaphore, and we put the two landing craft in under the rocks, covered them over with camouflage nets, and hoped we wouldn't be spottable from the air. Well, we weren't spotted from the air, but of course we were spotted by the local Arabs on the beach. And in the middle of the morning, my lookout reported that there was a European walking across the beach, the other side of the rocks, which we were hiding under, in our direction. So I put my head over the top, and indeed there was an elderly man in a straw hat, and so I went out to meet him. And he said, well, he's delighted to see us. We were the first Allied troops he'd met. He was a retired French horse gunner officer who belonged to a quite well-known Grenoble family, the Perrin, who had a glove factory there, the Grand Perrin, was very well known in France at the time. But this chap had retired from the French army some years before the First World War, at a time when he had been making maps for the French army of that part of Tunisia, and decided it was a place he'd like to live, so he got a concession of land up at Cap Serra and set up as a farmer. And then, of course, 1914 came and he was called up again and was away till 1920. When he came back, his house had been destroyed by the local Arabs, and they cut down his trees, fruit trees and his olive trees, and they carried off his livestock. But he went to work again, and he started, and he built himself another house and started farming, and there he was. And he spoke admirable Arabic. He could write Arabic as well as speak it. And he had great local standing, because people came from the local villages to ask his advice and to ask him to write letters for them and this sort of thing. Well, all this emerged in conversation, and he said, well, is there anything I can do to help you? So I said, well, there may well be, because the weather was still bad, and I didn't think we were going to be any more successful in doing a sea landing at Bizerta that night. So I said, could you find horses and a guide who knows the way to Bizerta? So he said, yes, he certainly could do that. So I asked him to get on and arrange it, and went up the hill to look at the lighthouse and the semaphore station, and I discovered there was a French naval signals crew of about four who had a telephone line to the French naval base at Bizerta under command of Admiral Esteva, and there was also the lighthouse crew in the separate building alongside with housing the lighthouse. So I thought, well, good heavens, this telephone line is really rather a menace, because presumably the news of what we're up to will be immediately back in Bizerta. So I cut the telephone line, and to make it more difficult to re-establish, I pulled several hundred yards of it down with a horse attached to it, or mule, and threw that well away over into some water. And then in the evening we rounded our horses and our guide up, and we set off for Bizerta. And we would have been the guide, myself, and the two agents. I think possibly that was the whole party. But the guide managed to lose his way during the night. And we eventually decided that we'd have to wait for daybreak so we could see where we were. Because we had really no local knowledge, whatever, apart from him. And so we bivouacked under some trees somewhere, and then at first light continued our journey eastwards. And in due course, we came to a large clearing with a German infantry company having a morning inspection in it, all drawn up in a line. Well, fortunately, they were more surprised to see us than we were to see them. So we had disappeared back whence we came before they actually started shooting. But we decided, really, we couldn't get through that way on horseback. So we returned back to Cap Serrat, handed over the horses, thanked Perrin for his help, and returned back to Debarca in the landing craft that night, the following night, having to report that we had not been able to land these two chaps at, but that Cap Serrat looked a quite interesting sight, as it had not only very good visibility in all directions and was pretty defensible, but it had this great source of local knowledge in the person of Perrin available up there, who seemed to be entirely cooperative.